Wonderful. Let's open those Bibles, shall we? Or keep them open. Mind you, we're going to move on now from the Acts of the Apostles back to our reading from Nehemiah. Wonderful to see you all, everybody. Wonderful to see that wonderful baptism just a moment ago, and to greet the dear family and to have had a part in that. Now today, we're coming to our final look at this stirring book of Nehemiah. Here we are in the last chapter, 13, and verses 1 to 11, page 499. Good idea to have the Bible open. So we start at verse 14 itself with the prayer and testimony that Nehemiah, God's servant, utters to the Lord of heaven. So look with me at Nehemiah 13, verse 14. In the words of his prayer, remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services. Someone new here might be asking, well, what was it that this man Nehemiah had so faithfully been doing in what he calls the house of his God? Over the past Sundays, we've been studying the achievements of this man, a man who lived at the same time as the mighty Greek philosopher Plato, one of the cleverest men who ever lived. Yet while Plato today is really only specialist reading for a few, Nehemiah is familiar across the world to millions who make up what is known as the House of God. The very thing that captivated the energies of Nehemiah. So what is the house of God? Ultimately, the house of God, in true Bible terms, isn't a building so much as people. You and I are part of the house of God today. We also call it the church. Sure, we talk of buildings like this as the church, but technically, well, this building is really what keeps the rain off the church. Because the church, why, it's we, the people, who are the church. And after we just had introduced to the life of the church the newest member, Genevieve, with her older sister, Grace, surely going to give her guidance and to remind her in future days of this great day. And we, the people of God, yes, we are, we're that. And it was the people of God that Nehemiah was working for all those years, his own fellow Jews, who were God's chosen people, the church of that time, the household of God in the 5th century BC. Not that they felt like that when Nehemiah started to help them. They were little more than downtrodden serfs taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, those many years earlier, the country of Iraq today. But by Nehemiah's time, Medo-Persia had taken over from Babylon as the world power, and the Jews were being given permission to return to their own land of Judah. But their back had been broken as a people, and it fell to one man of their number, Nehemiah, to pave the way for their return and to rebuild not only the walls of Jerusalem against considerable opposition from jealous Samaritans, but also to rebuild the very morale and spiritual well-being of themselves that Nehemiah knew as the house of my God. That's what we've been looking at over these past Sundays, at the remarkable spiritual achievements of, boom, one man. A great prophet, you might think. No, Nehemiah in no way was a prophet. Well then, a member of the holy Jewish priesthood? No, not at all. Nehemiah was a layman. He was a butler, in fact, to Artaxerxes, who then ruled Persia. And the story of Nehemiah is only one of many, many reminders that again and again, when the Lord God wants to have something done, what does he do? He seems to choose so often the non-professionals, the lay people. He'll take a farmer by the name of Gideon to deal with the Midianites and give peace to the land. He'll take one of six men serving at dinner tables, Stephen by name, to be a preacher brave enough to challenge the spiritual status quo of a whole nation and become Christianity's first martyr. Think about it. God picks on one man, not a clergyman, called Hudson Taylor, who hadn't even finished his medical studies in Britain, to begin a new work in China, to battle for souls, and to confront the opium trade. Or how did the Church Missionary Society begin? Why, a man called William Wilberforce, MP, wrote in his diary on November the 9th, 1796, I quote, "dined and slept at Battersea Rise for missionary meeting." It was later on that the historian Eugene Stock wrote this observation: "That dinner at Clapham on November the 9th was more important to the world's history than the Lord Mayor's banquet at the Guildhall the same evening." That was CMS. Of course, through the new society of CMS, Africa was going to be reached, India too, and the East. Let's recognize, ladies and gentlemen, that these stirring enterprises never seem to spring out of church-appointed official committees. Not at all. In fact, when it came to it, the bishops of England took no great part in encouraging the beginning of CMS. They weren't really very interested. It was left to others. A dinner party started CMS. Well, it was the same with Nehemiah serving the after-dinner port to his boss, Artaxerxes, who finally agreed on a deal that his butler could leave for Jerusalem 500 miles away and start a new work. And the rest, as they say, is history. Now is towards the end of the adventure here in chapter 13. Look at it again in your Bible. Chapter 13, verse 14. Yet another of Nehemiah's one-sentence prayers of the heart. Look at it. "Remember me for this, O my God, and do not blot out what I have so faithfully done for the house of my God and its services." Maybe that's a recurring prayer on the part of many, many workers in the life of God's kingdom, whether they are lay people or not. Let not what's been done get blotted out. Because that can happen. That Christian summer house party, that Moldova mission visit to Kenya, that message we heard years ago that led us to faith in Jesus Christ, that daily habit once we had of reading the Bible, the baptism of baby Genevieve. Well, of course, we will leave it to her older sister Grace not to let that be blotted out ever, as she grows to be a real believer. But the years can all too easily take their toll until a man or woman, a family, a church, or an entire nation has forgotten every past blessing of God and are now lost in a backwater of unhappiness without even knowing the cause of such unhappiness. This is happening at the present time in Europe and all of the West. It is as though for many people the Bible itself had been blotted out. Listen, in this our chapter, this very blotting out was beginning to happen to Judah. Nehemiah, from verse 4 of chapter 13 here, he tells of the unraveling process, that despite all the progress that had been made in Judah's restoration, was beginning to set in the moment he turned his back. Do you see it there in verse 6? Referring to the spiritual compromises that were taking place, he says, verse 6, "But while all this was going on, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. You see what he's saying? After 12 years there in Jerusalem with the building of the wall and everything, Nehemiah's leave of absence from the king, from his boss, was up. It was almost like a sort of sabbatical that Nehemiah was taking, because he was allowed to come back again to Jerusalem some while later. Well, of course, this can happen to sabbaticals. You take several months off and come back to chaos. Do some of you business people know that? Has that ever happened? I've never, in 50 years or more of ministry, I've never taken a sabbatical because of my fear of what I would find when I get back. This is what is happening here. Nehemiah's time away from Jerusalem must have been quite prolonged, because on returning, plenty that he'd built up was beginning to falter. First, the faith was under threat. It's there in verses 4 to 9. While Nehemiah was away, Eliashib, the priest, did a compromise deal with Tobiah the Ammonite, who, if you remember from our earlier studies, Tobiah with Sanballat was bitterly opposed to all that Nehemiah was attempting. So Eliashib, giving access and influence in the temple area to a man of another outlook and belief, was to undermine the purity of Israel's unique faith. And it's a perpetual danger in every era. The tendency towards what would be called today multi-faith worship, multi-faith religion. It's one of our greatest challenges today. Verse 8 here sees the swift ejection of Tobiah by the indignant Nehemiah when he gets back. The faith had come under threat. But then secondly, friends, the ministry was under threat. Look at verses 10 to 13. While Nehemiah was away, the people began to stop giving their tithes to support the ministry in the temple by the Levite priests. The Levites abandoned their posts, moved out into the country, and began again as farmers. Confidence in the life of the temple began to wane. Well, of course, this is the acid test facing the standards of worship and ministry of any church down the ages. The acid test of a church is the unspoken question by the average worshipper: have I got the confidence to bring to church my atheistic neighbor on any given Sunday and know for sure it won't be too bad? It'll be all right. It'll be credible. Naturally, this issue has to be worked at by us all. So also by Nehemiah. Verse 1. Why is the house of God neglected? He asks. He calls them together. He makes new and trustworthy appointments. Then looks to see whether anything else has declined in his absence. It has. As well as with the faith and the ministry, thirdly, he discovers that the Sabbath was under threat. It's all here. Verses 15 to 22. There was buying and selling, you can read there, marketing, trading, little attention paid to the fourth of the Ten Commandments. Hey, how well do we know the Ten Commandments? Quite well. Maybe for some of us, September would be a good month to go over the Ten Commandments all over again and get them off by heart. All ten. It's all there in Exodus chapter 20. Again, Nehemiah is obliged to take action on that fourth commandment, shutting the city's gates on the eve of the Sabbath, posting guards, alerting the Levite priests to salvage creation's one day in seven principle. And we have to do the same today. You know, Christians in the developing countries are better at this than we in the West. People in Zimbabwe, where I visited, they're prepared to walk 20 miles to church on a Sunday because Sunday is so special. When I was visiting the biggest shanty town in the world, Kibera, 3 miles out of Nairobi. It was a Sunday. And despite the tin shacks and the mud underfoot, the men would come out wearing their only suit as they came out of their homes to go to church. To them, Sunday was the day, the Sabbath. Actually, my wife Pam here, when she was visiting Haiti once, perhaps the poorest country in the world, she told me that the Christians would dress on Sunday as if they were going to a wedding. It's the same in Nigeria. I feel I can learn from these sisters and brothers and treat that seventh day as what it was from the start, as a day established as a creation ordinance. Even before the Ten Commandments were given, Sunday, even then, the seventh day after 6 days of labor, was desperately central. That the one day in seven isn't just another day, it's a day for God. The other creation ordinance that was there from the very beginning, before the Ten Commandments, was marriage. Genesis 2, verse 24, "A man will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two of them shall become one flesh." That's Genesis 2, 24. There was the definitive standard, underlined and endorsed by Jesus in Matthew chapter 19. So marriage was a further item that Nehemiah was shaken to observe as being under threat on his return from Artaxerxes. All of these elements of life with God were utterly basic. Nehemiah found the faith to be under threat, the ministry, the Sabbath, and so fourthly, marriage being under threat. It's here, in verses 23 to 27, the issue of the intermarriage that was taking place between Jews and others was not racial, but religious. So, verse 24, 26, young children of these marriages were speaking the Ashdod language, which was the heathen language of the alien Philistines. That's what Nehemiah found when he got back. And verse 25, Nehemiah pronounces a curse on these proceedings. Not a curse as today we understand curses, but the words of sober judgment on those who transgressed the God-given standards of marriage. You'll notice from verse 26 that Nehemiah refers as well to the sins of King Solomon in regard to marriage. You saw that there? Well, as we know from the Book of Kings, Solomon was into multiple marriages, many of them from alien belief systems. 700 wives in all, besides some 300 mistress partners. How could that ever fit in with Genesis 2:24? Actually, we wonder how Solomon himself ever managed with all these weddings. Waking up one morning and thinking, goodness, who is it going to be today? Wait a moment. Have we got a cake for today? Maybe last week's wedding cake will do for today. Well, when it comes to the children, the grandchildren as well, for Solomon, birthdays must have been a nightmare. And this issue, the marriage, it seriously affects any civilization in the world. In his book, Sex and Culture, J.D. Unwin of Cambridge University studied umpteen primitive tribes and numerous civilizations throughout 5,000 years of history. And he declared, now I give you his quoted words, this is J.D. Unwin, "The whole of human history does not contain a single instance of a group becoming civilized unless it has been completely monogamous in marriage." He also made the point that after a nation becomes prosperous, it becomes increasingly liberal and loose with regard to sexual morality. And as a result, he said, loses its cohesion, its impetus, and its purpose. The process, he said, is irreversible. That's J.D. Unwin. Pray then, both for the USA and Britain, and also for Europe, that a true reawakening to Jesus Christ may, by God's intervening grace, prove this irreversible process to be reversible after all. It could happen. Bishop Butler of England wrote England off as beyond hope back earlier in the 18th century. Then came the Wesley brothers, who said to each other, by God's grace, we are going to change the course of history. And they were given 50 years of preaching to do it. And it happened. Now let's think about this marriage. The security of marriage and the family is the shop window of a true civilization and a Christian nation. All four indications of decay that confronted Nehemiah on return from his sabbatical, they face us today. The faith is under threat today. The ministry is under threat. Sabbath is under threat. Marriage is under threat. And we realize all too well from history that when a civilization falls, it usually falls from within. So this Sunday morning we may ask, is there anything that I, as a single individual, can do? Psalm 11, verse 3, puts that very question in these words: when the foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do? Maybe the answer is, don't get isolated. Stay in the fellowship of Christ and his church. Also, don't become short-sighted, but keep your eyes on the throne and rule of God in Jesus Christ. As that Christian leader, Festo Kivenjeri from Uganda, once declared in my hearing, he said, Satan can roar like a lion, but he has no authority to shake the throne on which Jesus is sitting. And therefore, don't get intimidated either. As we take our share in the prayers of God's people worldwide, like Nehemiah, we can pray, remember us, O our God, and do not blot out all that has so faithfully been done through past heroes of the faith in this country. Let me stand with them in my witness, my prayers, as I get committed to see this through. True, you and I may see ourselves only as limited individuals. But then Nehemiah, a lay person, was only one. I close with a little poem that went into my autograph album when I was 10 years old. My older brother Peter had already asked our uncle, Anstis Buse, for an autograph, and he had written a funny one. Peter then was very stern with me. Don't ask Uncle Anstis for a funny autograph as well. You're to ask for a serious one. So meekly I asked, a serious one, please, Uncle Anstis. And what he wrote was a poem from his dad, my grandfather, Thomas Buse. I give the words to you now. I am only one, but I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. What I can do, I ought to do. And what I ought to do, by the grace of God, I will do. And that was Nehemiah all over. And you too. And you too.